Coming up on this special episode of the GeekWire podcast, a conversation with Bill Gates about what's on his mind in 2019, including what he would say to President Trump.
You know, I'd want him to go and see that, you know, meet those people and think about, okay, should we stay engaged there?
Why he's advocating for nuclear energy.
I believe there can be a new generation that would be competitive with any other energy source.
A remembrance of his late Microsoft co-founder, Paul Allen.
Now, as my kids are getting older and leaving school, I was going to have more time to hang out with Paul.
And Bill Gates breaks his silence on one of the biggest stories of the year so far.
What do you say to people who will call you a burger flip-flopper?
I absolutely love both. You know, I'll eat lots of different burgers at various times.
From GeekWire.com in Seattle, I'm Todd Bishop. Stick with us as we catch up with Bill Gates. I got a chance to speak with Bill Gates at his private office in the Seattle region in advance of the release Tuesday of the 2019 annual letter from Bill and Melinda Gates, focusing this time on 10 things that have surprised them in their work on health, education, and other global issues. That's where we began our conversation, in a roundabout way.
Bill Gates, thanks very much for joining us.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too. So we're here to talk about your annual letter written with Melinda. And I want to get to the serious stuff in a second, but you write in this letter about what surprised you over the past year. And I want to tell you what surprised me about you. And that is, you are one heck of a tennis player, Bill Gates.
Uh-oh.
You played on the same doubles team as Roger Federer. And I have to tell you, I know a thing or two about tennis. It's my sport. You did not miss a serve in an entire set. How did you find the time to train to the extent that you were that confident in that match?
Well, Roger makes it easy. He's super friendly. We've actually gotten to do two events, one here in Seattle and one was an arena down in San Jose.
With Samantha Guthrie.
Exactly. We're even talking about where we might do a third. He's going to do more stuff in Africa, but that would be hard to schedule, or Japan. I was sorry to see him not make it to the finals of the Australian Open, even though, Djokovic certainly put on an amazing display of tennis talent. But Rogers really is a special person. His charity does education things. His mom is from South Africa. He has the same parentage as Trevor Noah. He has a South African mom and a Swiss dad.
Yeah. So if he's teaching you about the backhand slice, what are you teaching him about philanthropy and big global issues?
Oh, not that much. because he doesn't, it's not like golf where you hang around amateurs all the time and maybe you get your fill of it. He's like so excited. Oh, you guys like tennis too? And we did a clinic over at Bellevue Athletic Club, and he, came early, stayed late. He was super friendly. And then, his wife, Mirka, was also a tennis player. And they've got, lots of young kids. So it's a pleasure to have a role model like Roger.
All right, let's get into the serious stuff.
Sure.
Here. So in your annual letter, one of the points that you make, and I think this may be the point that's going to get the most attention when this letter comes out, is that there is a nationalist case for globalism. Very important topic right now, not only in the United States, but in Europe and other parts of the world. Let's hear your nationalist case for globalism.
Yeah, so if you disengage from the world, the instability in terms of those economies, diseases that can spread globally very quickly, there's lots of reasons why that's going to hurt you. And so even if you say that the normal sort of empathetic humanitarian reasons of all lives have equal value and it bothers you that young children are dying in those countries, even if you zero that out, my view is that the impact per dollar of the aid, which in the case of the U.S. Is not even 0.5% of the budget, that as General Mattis has said, that if you don't fund the aid budget, you'll have to spend more money on bullets. And that case that, getting Vietnam to develop, and so we no longer think of it as, a place we need to send soldiers to. Now it's actually done well enough, it's graduating as an aid recipient. That is, its domestic resources are funding things. India's graduating, Indonesia's graduating. Africa's a tougher set of countries, but even there, the health improvements, which is a foundational piece, the health improvements have been super rapid. And that's the place where our foundation plays a strong role. We've given over $10 billion to these health-related activities, and you know, we've seen a fantastic result. So, you know, we're going to keep doing that.
It seems, though, a very difficult case to make in the world today, in the U.S. and internationally. Is that fact a blip? In other words, are we just happening to encounter temporary opposition to that view of a nationalist case for globalism, or is this the way it is going to be going forward? What's your position on that?
Well, definitely, if people are disappointed in their government, they feel like it's not respecting their values, or it's not prioritizing them, or let somebody else get in a better deal than they get, that just general negativity can lead to the government not being able to invest in these long-term issues. And if voters feel like, okay, the elites kind of like doing this stuff and the elites are not caring about us, that really hurts. So it's absolutely a wave of questioning, a lot of things, but including should we be in alliances with other countries like NATO? You know, should we, the U.S., you know, take this leading role in helping make the world a very, very stable place? Or we should just, you know, sort of say, okay, that's a waste of money. We won't help out with those things. Since World War II, you've almost taken for granted that the world is getting more stable and that these investments make sense. I'm hoping it's a cyclical thing, particularly if we can, you know, get people to go and see the work. Anybody who goes and sees it, you know, gets very drawn in because you see the kids who are still dying, you see the kids who are surviving, you see how, you know, it's very little money. This is the investment. That stability is important even here in the U.S. You know, we don't want Ebola or a flu coming out of developing countries coming here.
What would you say on this topic to President Trump and congressional leaders?
Well, I haven't seen him for quite a while, but the American voters should be very proud of these programs that President Bush started. He said that there was an AIDS emergency and created a U.S.-only thing called PEPFAR that's very generous, over $5 billion a year. He said the U.S. would be a third of the global fund where lots and lots of countries give. So the U.S. has been out in front, and 23 million people are alive today because of that generosity. So, you know, I'd want him to go in and see that, you know, meet those people and think about, okay, Africa, we've got this great population growth. It's got a challenge from climate change. That's where most of the challenge will be. Should we stay engaged there with aid programs that aren't gigantic? I mean, the U.S., you know, our defense budget is way larger than anybody else's. The aid budget isn't 5% of the defense budget, and yet it does help with the same kind of aims.
It seems like you've been engaging a little bit more politically. You were on Capitol Hill just recently talking about nuclear energy. Are you doing that willingly, or do you see that as something that you have to do to get your message across these days?
Well, the foundation can't achieve ambitious goals in global health without deep partnerships with the rich countries that provide most of the aid. You know, so that we put in $10 billion, but the rich countries put in $90 billion, and that's why we have these big results. And there's no way if they pull back to replace that, it's just going to result in millions of deaths. I try and talk to politicians mostly about the topics where I'm spending lots of money and, you know, able to spend tons of time with the scientists and the people are very analytic, and so hopefully I have some information that's helpful to them. Climate change is one where the so-called adaptation, where you help farmers have better seeds so that the when the drought comes, they're not their family's not malnourished. That's done through the foundation. The thing where you try and have innovations and emit less greenhouse gases, that's about power plants and making steel and cement. So I do that outside the foundation, and it is one that I, you know, sitting with the people who support nuclear energy and saying, hey, can this help with climate change? How does the U.S. see its role here? The nuclear industry in the U.S. may completely disappear because the current designs aren't economic compared to the price of natural gas. And yet, I believe there can be a new generation that would be competitive with any other energy source. So yes, I'm back in DC quite a bit, but I wouldn't say that's completely new. It's really the foundation's work needs those partnerships.
So what does Bill Gates say to people who criticize his focus on nuclear energy? We'll be back with the answer to that and much more of our conversation with Bill Gates.
Technology moves fast. I need to move faster. WGU's competency-based education puts me in control of how fast I move through my IT degree program. I can accelerate my program by applying what I already know to my courses and focusing on the things I need to learn. Earn a respected accredited degree that propels your career in the IT field. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
Welcome back to GeekWire and our interview with Bill Gates. He's been spending time on Capitol Hill lately trying to persuade U.S. leaders to regain America's leading role in nuclear energy research and embrace advanced nuclear technologies, such as the concept being developed by his own TerraPower nuclear venture. I asked him how he would respond to people who would advocate instead for forms of green energy, such as wind and solar power.
Do you see it as an either or? Do you see it as a competition between nuclear and those? How do you respond to the criticism of your support of nuclear energy?
No, in most places, if you have the right amount of wind or sun, that's going to be a significant power source. It's still less than 2% of global power, but it is, along with natural gas, growing quite a bit. There's several issues. You need power 24 hours a day. And, you know, Tokyo has 7 days every year with no sun and no wind. It's a 23 gigawatt power consumption. And so we don't make enough batteries in the world to handle that situation, ignoring even the economics. And the so we, because we won't have a battery that's good enough for that 24-hour storage, we need other sources of power. You know, hospitals want power all night when it's super cold, like, you know, in Chicago now. People want their heaters to work. And so even for the electricity piece, that reliability is a challenge. That's only 25%. The word clean energy has kind of fooled people to not really let them know about the 75% that's not electricity. It's more making steel and cement. The kind of extreme heat you get out of reactor, or some reactors, actually helps you with those areas of greenhouse gas emissions in a way that just renewable energy doesn't. So it's great. You know, the price of electricity when the sun is shining will be low, but it will be a lot higher at other times.
You write in the letter that you wish more people fully understood what it will take to stop climate change. What is it going to take?
Well, you have to innovate in all the areas of sources, and you have to innovate in such a way that not only do rich countries say, okay, we'll pay a premium for our steel and our electricity, but you have to turn to a country like India that's electricity is just now starting to provide basics like air conditioning and lighting. And if you ask them to pay a big premium, will they really choose to when they're not responsible for the greenhouse gas that's already been emitted. Per person, we've emitted 1,000 times as much as an Indian citizen. So, you know, until they get to the level we have, should they slow down the helping with basic needs? And the only thing that gets around that trade-off is if you're so innovative that there's no premium cost to being zero emission across making meat, cement, steel, trucks, planes, you know, a lot of sources.
So I remember from talking with you on this topic last time on the issue of the political climate, and I remember listening back, and you were being careful not to explicitly criticize President Trump. Is that a purposeful approach on your part to be careful not to become a lightning rod or a target in that way?
Well, I'm one voter. I have one vote. There are areas like development aid where the Trump administration in its first year suggested a 20% cut. And, you know, we were very vocal about, we disagreed that 5 million lives would be lost due to HIV because of that. The good news is that the Congress, including a lot of Republicans, didn't even put that to a vote. They said, no, our values are such, our belief in that America's not so poor that we can't help out with this $100 medicine that keeps people alive, that reflects our values. And we're not, you know, we have this super strong economy. And so, you know, deciding to make cuts to let people die isn't a priority for us. So the Congress has been great for the aid type issues that we work on. So when it comes to an area that, you know, we are putting billions of our money into, and that we get to go out and see the things, we will speak out. You know, every other political issue, we have to be careful because we don't know a lot more, then we're diluting our voice on the issues where we feel strongly and we're deeply involved.
On those issues, one of the things that you've been looking at more frequently at the Gates Foundation in the U.S. is poverty, and also you're looking increasingly at behavioral development and emotional maturity among kids as they grow up. You had a fascinating experience that you write about in the letter with a group of high school students. Tell us about this.
Well, it was a phenomenal thing where these young men, they were all black from single parent households. The counselor had grown up in that environment. And they have multiple times a week a circle where they go around and talk to each other. And there's a real sense of camaraderie. You know, they introduce each other, what they're up to. And then they were asked to talk about anger. And so I got to participate, you know, and hear how they thought about anger and, you know, how they thought they had handled that situation.
You're very introspective in the letter, and the group is called Becoming a Man.
Or exactly, BAM.
BAM. And I was struck that you said that the example you gave them of yourself getting angry was a meeting where you heard that the number of polio cases went up. Did you really just fly off the handle over that?
Well, it's very disappointing because, you know, we've gotten, you know, Rotary and all these donors, and we're so close, and yet every year we have cases. You know, it's another year, it's a total of about $1 billion that's going into this. And it's, you know, kind of a disappointment where people question, okay, can global health really get tough things done? Our biggest problem is in Pakistan, Afghanistan. But yes, when I open an email that says there were more polio cases, I have to deal with the huge disappointment.
Well, you also thought about yourself and your own career, and you wrote, growing up, if I thought my parents were being unfair, I could be pretty harsh with them. When I was at Microsoft, I was tough on people I worked with. Some of it helped us be successful, but I'm sure some of it was over the top. So it was inspiring to see these young men in such tough circumstances working on this skill much earlier than I did. What did you learn from the experience, and especially given the overall discussion in society in the U.S., especially right now, about masculinity in the workplace and how that manifests itself? How did it change your perspective?
Well, I was super impressed with how engaged the boys were. And it definitely made me feel like this type of intervention is very, very important. I mean, when we just look at the statistics and we see particularly black males from single parent households have very high dropout rates, worse than the girls, even worse than say Caucasian or Hispanic households at the same level of income. And so how do you get that sense of, okay, I belong in school, I have a sense of where I'm going. And these groups, by sitting and talking with these boys about the paths that are available to them, help them have a sense of support, somebody who's celebrating when they're doing well, somebody who can help out when they're not. You know, it looks like something that should really be scaled up. And in the face of the fact that those statistics have not improved much, you know, even as, okay, you teach math better, you improve the textbook, but you're not really getting to the core of the self-image of these students who are in a very tough environment. So the idea that, boy, we may need to add that, they definitely drew me in.
Let's dive into one other area of education here, because there was a whole section of the letter that made me think, man, if I had time warped to 2019 from 1995, having just read The Road Ahead, and then reading your description of how textbooks have evolved, and are starting to evolve. I would have gone, this didn't happen two decades ago. You know, I would have expected it to happen much faster. Describe what you're seeing in the world of textbooks and why you think it's working for a new era of education.
Well, when you take that math textbook home and you're trying to do those exercises, you can get kind of stuck, or you can think maybe you're getting it right and you're not. In this digital world, the idea that the software can generate the homework and generate it at the right level, and then if you need a hint, fine, you get the hint. You know, your teacher sees, oh, he needed a hint. He didn't just get it, so maybe he has to try this out a little bit more. But, you know, the feedback used to be like 3 days later, and you'd be like, oh, I really screwed this up. God, what were we working on then? That was 3 days ago. And, you know, now when you're just sitting there with your phone or tablet or PC, you'll get that feedback. We're much further along in terms of taking that experience for math and making it a richer experience. For things like writing papers, we're starting for this big history course that several thousand schools have. You actually write the paper and you can immediately get feedback. And that's an AI software thing that won't replace the teacher feedback, but for some low level things like the grammar, punctuation, various things, and it's the structure of your essay, have all the right pieces in it. I think it will help students learn.
Why hasn't it happened already? Why isn't this our reality now?
Well, the textbook market is a tough market. And the, who should really try this stuff out, and where should the R&D money come from for these things? It's really not like a normal consumer market, and you've got to get the equipment in. So, having PCs or tablets all the time is much easier now than 10 years ago, where you had to walk into the lab and some of them would be broken. Now, ideally, some of this can be done just on the cell phone screen. Not all of it can, but actually quite a bit of it can. That is nearly pervasive at this point. It is moving slower than it should. Educational innovation, we as a society way underinvest in. And You know, we're trying to get some of these private sector companies to do well, but a lot of them, just as they try to build a sales force, the economics don't work very well.
Coming up, Bill Gates reflects on the life of his late Microsoft co-founder, Paul Allen. Welcome back to GeekWire. Let's rejoin our conversation with Bill Gates.
So you and Melinda dedicate the letter to Paul Allen, your Microsoft co-founder, who died of cancer in October. As you've reflected on his life over the past couple months and your shared experience with him, what have been your biggest memories and your insights from the time that you spent with Paul?
Well, Paul was immensely curious, and he read science fiction way more than I did. He was 2 years ahead of me, and I had done super well on some math stuff. So he was always kind of egging me on, hey, can you figure this computer thing out? And it was, you know, it was an amazing friendship because kids didn't hang out that much with kids who were 2 years younger. We were very much bonded when we did the school schedule together. You know, Paul had gone off to Washington State, and my closest friend, who was also involved in the computer thing, Kent Evans, was tragically killed on Mount Rainier. And so I went to Paul and said, hey, come back and help me. And that sort of started a partnership that led to Microsoft. And, you know, Paul's credit for Microsoft is pretty immense because not only did he have this insight about the microprocessor, he literally moved back to Boston to, you know, not I helped him get a job back there, but he was back there not because he liked the winters or the place he was living, to basically bug me into dropping out because he knew he wanted to do the company with me. So he was just back there. And then finally, it looked like we were going to miss the whole thing when the first kit computer came out. And that's when his argument, hey, Bill, drop out, succeeded. And our first customer took us to Albuquerque, New Mexico. So Paul, you know, always was curious about things. You know, Paul didn't like being a manager all that much. He was always... And during the Microsoft days, I narrowed my interest very much to software. And so, like, when Paul took a bunch of guys to go to the shuttle launch, I was like, hey, wait a minute. We're supposed to deliver for IBM here. What the heck are you doing?
So you heard about this DOS thing? Come on, guys.
Yes. so, you know, he always was wide-ranging in his thinking and reading. If you go into his office, there would just be magazines, you know, kind of messy, but it you know, represent his broad interest. And even after Microsoft, he was funding lots of different things. You know, in the tech area, like Starwave that Mike Slade ran ended up being the ESPN website. I don't think many people know that. That went pretty well. Some of them were more a dead end, but like Asymmetrics, but they were pointing in the right direction for things. So he, you know, he always looked far afield. He always, you know, wanted to find some new and different thing, you know, always a little bit ahead of his time with the stuff he was doing. And, you know, now as my, you know, kids are getting older and leaving school, I was going to have more time to hang out with Paul because he's, you know, he sort of explored the, hey, traveled the world, you know, have nice boats thing, which I got to do some with him. But I was expecting to do a ton of that once our kids were at college.
Where are you at this point in terms of coming to grips with the fact that he's not here?
Well, it's kind of strange because, you know, we always would kind of touch base on, hey, there's this cool movie I saw, or here's some new technical thing. Do we think this one's going to work out or not? And, you know, Paul always was worried about his health. It's almost, this was his third bout of cancer. The first one in 1983 was when he stopped working at Microsoft, and it changed his perspective. He didn't want to come back and work like I wanted people to work, which actually I was disappointed, but anyway, it worked out fine. Then he had another bout in 2011, And now, so, you know, and Paul always had challenges with health. And, you know, I actually think he was worried, you know, so it's awful that he was right. And that, you know, was kind of hanging over him quite a bit. You know, his sister's going to carry on a lot of the charitable stuff he did. He was, you know, part of the Giving Pledge, so the majority of his wealth will go to charitable things. And I'm actually seeing a friend of his, Bert Colde, and Allison this week, just, you know, sort of talk more about Paul and, you know, the great memories we have.
We've talked about a lot of divisive issues here today. You recently put yourself right square in the middle of one. Somebody got a picture of you standing outside of Dick's Hamburgers, waiting in line for a Dick's Burger. You are a longtime Burger Master fan. What do you say to people who would call you a burger flip-flopper?
I absolutely love both. and, you know, I'm not, you know, I'll eat lots of different burgers at various times, but, you know, my two stark favorites are Burger Master. I guess I'm not as photogenic when I'm sitting in my cars, when I'm standing in a long line.
At Dick's, yes.
At Dick's. But, you know, they're both pretty amazing. The one thing about Dick's, I will say, the fries are pretty good. It's hard to beat the Dick's fries.
One of my favorite quotes of yours from the years was, a student asked you how she could become like you and how she could become a billionaire. And you said, I don't know, I'll tell you, it's the same burger.
Yeah.
it's still the same burger?
Consumption goes up a little bit. You know, I have an expensive tennis racket, but...
Yeah, well, you need that if you're going to play with Roger Federer.
Absolutely.
Bill Gates, thank you very much.
Yeah,
great to see you.
Yeah.
Now, before we go, I got to share more of this. That was just part of our conversation about hamburgers. During the mic check before we began the interview, the subject also came up, and Gates marveled at the fact that people cared so much about the fact that he stood in line for a burger.
Absolutely. It's mind-blowing. I mean, just, you know, in Nigeria, it's a gigantic story. Really, it broke through in an unbelievable way.
Well, now you have a sense for our reach, right?
Yeah.
on the important stories, right? Go to GeekWire with the standing in line at the burger place.
Yeah, no, if they had that WhatsApp thing where they try to watch things that are going viral, they would have had to block it. I go to Burger Master all the time, but it's not, I guess it's photogenic when I'm in my cars standing in line.
Well, the original Microsoft office in the Seattle area was in Bellevue, around the corner from the Burger Master.
That's correct, right there.
I personally, if I had to choose, would pick Burger Master. If you forced me to choose one or the other, I would rather have a choice and not have to order directly off the menu. That's where I am.
Not as quick, though. Although, sometimes there's a line at Dick's, so.
Sometimes?
Yeah. Yeah, that's why you have to eat at a weird hour.
Well, when you have to stand in line, you know that it's an important place, right? It's like,
absolutely.
Bill's here, no, make him wait.
A big thanks to billionaire burger lover Bill Gates for being such a good sport. Check out GeekWire.com for full coverage and video of the interview and links to the 2019 annual letter from Bill and Melinda Gates. Be sure to subscribe and rate GeekWire in your favorite podcast app. And we'll be back later this week with our Week in Geek news roundup. Until next time, I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop. Thanks for listening, everybody.